Radio Egag. Today we have a very interesting topic for you. It's about international engagement with Somalia. Serious and contentious question surrounding the issue of how the international community should relate to Somalia. A major support be given to the transitional federal government. Should the African Union peacekeeping force be expanded? Should international support be directed to the federal government, or should it be redirected to the district and regional structures? To address these questions, the U.S. Institute of Peace sponsored a public workshop on international engagement in Somalia, a very interesting and much needed analysis that includes our very own Somali voices. Joy.
Started. Probably some latecomers will be joining us, but we'll fit them in. Please turn off your cell phones. Even to put them on vibrate interferes with the sound system, so I would ask you to actually turn them off. I want to welcome you to this event on Somalia, one of a series we've organized here over the years. Somalia has been a country of considerable concern to us, and say that we've made a significant contribution toward improving life for Somalis, but at least we address the issue periodically. You all know the basics of the Somalia situation. Somalia has been without a central government since 1991. Two areas are broken off into semi-autonomous regions. There have been 14 different efforts to establish a new government. Conference in Nairobi established the transitional federal government. Under the TFG, which has never really exerted effective control over the whole country, during that time there emerged the Islamic Courts Union, with a threat to the TFG, and established local courts and local peace in the communities where it controlled. The Ethiopians, feeling threatened by the Islamic courts, invaded with American encouragement and support in 2006. Americans were involved also in military strikes against presumed Al-Qaeda-connected terrorists. And when the Ethiopians invaded, the ICU fractured and fled, and then regrouped in new configuration and continued the insurgency. The Djibouti Accord came at the end of 2008 and the beginning of 2009, and a more inclusive TFG was created under the leadership of Lama Sheikh Sharif, a moderate Islamist. Ethiopia then withdrew its troops in early 2009, but the government has continued to be threatened by radical Islamists in at least two factions, the Al-Shabaab and the Hizbul Islam. In addition to the Ethiopian involvement, there have been AU involvement in the form of peacekeeping troops provided by Uganda and Burundi, and Eritrea has been a presumed financial and arms supplier for Al-Shabaab. So Somalia has become battleground for Ethiopia and Eritrea to carry on their long-sustained conflict. What we want to focus on today is what international engagement there should be with Somalia, whether continued support for the TFG will only enhance local support for the insurgents, or whether external support for the TFG would actually strengthen it and enable the TFG to be more effective government than it is today. So to look at the nature, the kind of support that would be effective, whether there should be continued support, and also to look at the question of whether if al-Shabaab were successful in taking over the government, how much of a threat would that be within Somalia and internationally, raising the question of what kind of an international agenda al-Shabaab has. We had originally planned on having three presenters today. Unfortunately, one of our presenters, Alan Thomas Jensen, has come ill and was not able to join us today. But our other two presenters are eminently qualified to address these issues, and I'm sure we will have a lively discussion after their presentations. I'll call on Bronwyn Bruton to be the first presenter. She's at the Council on Foreign Relations, picked up a more extensive bio data on both of our speakers on the table out in front. She also is the author of a very interesting and provocative article in the most recent issue of Foreign Affairs, and I'm sure she'll share some of the insights that that article contained in her presentation today. Bronwyn?
Thank you very much, David. Thank you, everyone, for coming today to talk about Somalia, which is one of the, I think, most overlooked crises in Africa today. Obviously, there's occasional discussion of the problem in the press, but it tends really to terror dynamic, and it's wonderful to have an opportunity. To quickly recap on what's happening in Somalia the past couple of years, as David mentioned, in 2006, a movement called the Union Islamic Courts appeared in Somalia after many, many years of anarchy. And although the Union of Islamic Courts was evidently a grassroots, bottom-up leadership movement that managed to bring a great deal of stability, at least to Mogadishu and its environs, the movement sparked concerns on the part of Ethiopia and the United States. It's evident that portions of the Union of Islam had ties to al-Qaeda. The fear that Somalia might eventually become a safe haven for al-Qaeda led Ethiopia to invade Somalia in December 2006 with vocal U.S. backing. The Union of Islamic Courts was defeated shockingly easily overnight by the Ethiopian army. But unfortunately, Ethiopia was obliged nevertheless to occupy Mogadishu, the reason being that the Transitional Federal Government, or TFG, was a weak institution that lacked popular backing from the community. It would have no chance of maintaining order in Mogadishu without the support of the Ethiopian occupation, in turn, sparked a complex insurgency that had the effect of catapulting what was essentially a fringe movement of a few fighters called the Shabaab into a national political movement. At the same time, the conduct of the Ethiopian army and the transitional federal government's troops during Ethiopia's occupation sparked outrage among Somalis across the globe and has apparently, again, we're in the early stages of this, so I don't want to be premature in a conclusion, but it appears to have sparked a process of homegrown radicalization here in the U.S. as in Europe, Australia. Obviously, this is not the intention of U.S. policy over the past several years, but it appears to be where we've arrived. The U.S. response has consistently that the TFG is the best hope, that, and ultimately that a sound government in Somalia is the only way, really, that we can prevent groups like al-Qaeda and other transnational terrorist organizations finding a safe haven in Somalia. In practice, though, that vision has been extreme. U.S. efforts to support the TFG have half-hearted at best. We've had several donors' conferences in which multiple countries have pledged support to the TFG. They've really failed to deliver that funding. We have a peacekeeping London in Burundi that have not been paid in 7 and 8 months. Several of them have died of malnutrition. They've suffered an extreme spike in their casualty rate in the past 8 months. They are basically embattled and crouching in a tiny corner of Mogadishu with very, very little capacity to pursue what are the fundamental U.S. goals in Somalia. Those goals are very simple. They are to prevent the spread of extremist ideologies and extremist forces through Somalia. They are to prevent al-Qaeda from finding a safe haven or an enabling environment in some corner. And to a lesser extent, they are to piracy along the coast. TFG is not capable of advancing any of those goals. Likely that they'll be able to cure. On the contrary, U.S. attempts to prop up the TFG have led to a terrible crisis in the capital city, a crisis that's displaced approximately 1 million plus the country, and they have 3.8 million people in Syria who are in need of food. And most of that, analysts think, is related to the conflict and the displacement. And these are essentially the conditions, obviously, in which radicalization will flourish. This is not a source of stability. This is a source of unrest and conflict. Conditions are basically making it more rather than less like pockets of Somalia as an enabling environment. In a recent piece in Foreign Affairs, I have argued that a cold-hearted cost-benefit analysis of the costs of supporting the TFG will reveal that the policy is doing more harm than good. It's a difficult argument to make because policymakers, to their credit, are eager to do. But I think that what we need to do at this stage is to step back and ask, given the options that we have at hand, whether there is anything that we can do constructively to address the crisis. And the argument that I've put forward is that instead a policy of rational response. There's a couple of pillars to this argument. The first one is that the Shabab, in some respects, a Frankenstein's monster. The group that only several years ago was many of them from outside of the country, and they've become a national political move, national efforts to confront the TFG. In addition to that, the Shabab is not monolith, and neither is the TFG. But although we have a tendency in the United States to look at the two sides in the conflict as moderate and extremist, in fact, sides are closer together than they appear. There are a number of members of the TFG who are sympathetic to the Shabab and vice versa. Both of these groups are composed of standing clan and economic factions, are opportunistically aligned with what we're calling moderate and extreme. And when we regard these sides as alliances of convenience, it begins to look rather it begins to look rather senseless to be fixated on backing one side against the other. The fact of the matter is that most likely, when this conflict has died down, neither side will be sustained. FG is faction-ridden. It's 550 parliamentarians, many of whom reside outside. Its ideology is unclear. Currently committed to a version of Sharia law, but we're not sure if it will be a harsh application of the Sharia, or it will combine some elements of secular law. There are real disputes among Somalis about whether Somalia should have a unitary government or a confederal or a federal structure. And with all of these disputes ongoing, it seems that efforts to construct a government sure, and will be a source of conflict. And in that regard, it's important to look back at the history of Somalia over the last 15 or 16 years, point out in the first place that even without the Shabab, even without any Islamist extremism in Somalia, multiple attempts to construct a government have failed. And if the Shabab were to disappear tomorrow, the TFG would face an insurmountable range of challenges, the same challenges that have defeated attempted regimes. A second point to consider is that the Shabab is facing it the way that the Shabab is fighting with its Islam allies in Kismayo. The vulnerabilities of the arrangement are very clear. They have an economic dispute, and similar factions are visible, various Shabab factions in the city of Shu, anywhere in the country where there is more than one Shabab militia, and even within militias, have fights over resource. And it reveals that much of this conflict is actually resource-based as opposed to ideological. Many Somali actors, while deeply committed to Islam, are pragmatic. And it would be far more sensible for the rest of this conflict as an economic and pragmatic problem as opposed to an ideological dispute over Islam. Again, you know, this is case, I think, of the United States attempting to fit Somalia not only inappropriate in terms of conflict, but has allowed radical groups in Somalia into a larger front on the war on terror. And the implications for U.S. policy. Ultimately, history suggests that no matter which side comes out on top in this current battle, they will face far greater challenges down the road, and that it's unlikely that either side will, especially absent strong support. If the United States wants to do productive in Somalia, the best thing that it can do, and not development as an instrumental tool of governance, but development for development, development to promote development, to give Somalis the opportunity to solve their own conflicts peacefully, organically, messily, and slowly, as they were in the process of doing prior to 2006, prior to our post-9/11 efforts to fix Somalia. I don't want to go on indefinitely, so I'll leave my comments there, but I do look forward to the types of development efforts that have worked, the types of reconciliation that have worked.
Thank you very much, Bronwyn. Our second presenter is Abubakar Arman, who is an independent author and blogger and analyst, and known to many of you for his insightful comments and analysis of the Somali.
Thank you, David, for patience, and thank you, Ms. for introduction. I would start with point of agreement, which offered, or the argument offered by Ms. Brewerton, which is the impact of using force only made things worse. I mean, all one has to do is look into Somalia, where it was in 2006 as today. Things are more desperate, and situation is more desperate. If we learn one thing from the 21st century, it is the fact that hard power, military option, is always the opposite of what it intended for. And if you look at the situation, as I said, in Somalia, what's needed is a paradigm shift, a new approach of some sort, something that has not been tried before. Today, I want to talk about international community and how it should engage Somalia. But first, before I go on, I wanted to define a political entity that we all understand as a international community, an entity that has no address. It has no office, no telephone number, no email. You cannot find it anywhere. Yet we all understand it somehow, what it means. So just to make things clear, I'll define international community to mean, in this case, any coalition of countries that's in support of the United States of America with, or partnering with the United States of America in providing a win-win situation for the political crisis in Somalia. When I say international community, that's who I'm talking about. Not the United Nations, not the International Contact Group for Somalia, which has a lot of different entities within it. Some of them don't even agree with where they want to go, their plan. They're taking it every direction. You have the EU on one hand, US on one hand, UN on the other hand. And then African Union on the other hand, and then a coalition of countries that, I mean, several countries that are front state countries, they have their own. So with that context, I will offer some suggestions. The strategic rationale that we've been hearing in one way or another as to why the international community should intervene in Somalia is to prevent the potential spread of transnational terrorism, as we heard Bruton visit on that issue. And also we hear that Somalia, Yemen, Pakistan, all of these countries is where Al-Qaeda is supposed to be spreading, establishing a base. Some even argue they already established a base in Somalia, although the evidence is not quite there yet. And then to prevent radicalization of the Somali diaspora youth, again, Ms. Bruton talked about that. Another thing that oftentimes you hear analysts mention is that floating command center called AFRICOM, whether Somalia would be a candidate for a station or not. Then you also have the indirect control of the lifeline of China, the emerging superpower, as to or political, I mean, security energy. Who controls that route? Controls the world, of course. And then to protect the world's most critical commercial arteries, piracy, of course, the Red Sea and Indian Ocean, as we mentioned. And then to monitor this and stabilize the threat coming from volatile geographical region that the Pentagon refers to as arc of instability, which includes Somalia and Ethiopia, Eritrea, Sudan. So these are basically the six arguments that are made in one way or another, favoring the intervention into Somalia. So the question is, why should the international community then support the current government? What makes it more special than the rest of the 14 failed attempted reconciliation and several governments and so forth? I would argue that, first of all, leaders don't come, I mean, they come as singles. And sometimes, without them having a proven record, we just trust because of the way the charisma that they have or the political clout that they walked in with. I think we just, a year ago, elected a president based on that. Not have a resume proving that he was a president elsewhere. But the hope that he generated and all of that, based on that, he was elected. So in this case, Somalia has one of those. As an individual who does not have the experience, is not coming because he was a president before or he has huge experience in international relations, or he even understands conceptually how the world works and all of that. Yet, we hang, as far as the support on this individual, because we think he projects that hope. Both in the diaspora and in Somalia, there's more of support. In fact, he was touring the U.S. about a month or two ago, and the expectation was that the Somali diaspora would be divided into two, some protesting against him, some in favor. He visited the most populated areas where Somalis congregate, Minneapolis, Columbus, and Washington, and he was welcomed. Of course, that was no single demonstration, to my knowledge. My fellow Somalis are present, they can contest. So that shows a great support, actually, from the diaspora, and even though they disagree with, because the TFG, of course, is not a perfect government by any stretch of the imagination. It has its own problems, as we can go and talk about that. So that's one main reason. The other reason is the timing is good, that the diaspora Somalis in the majority are fed up with this continuous war, and the attitude generally is like, want to start somewhere, want to establish law and order, and it's not going to be perfect, and we will all have to work towards that. And so that's the energy that one sense from both within the country and outside. And then, of course, there is a trend that's comparable to what was going on in the 6 months that the Islamic Courts Union, however controversial that entity was, now defunct. During their reign, of course, during their tenure, there was a flow of experts and technocrats and people who were educated Somalis who wanted just to go back and help these guys. And they knew they would disagree with some of the principles that they stood for, yet they were willing to help. The same attitude is now emerging with government, the current government. There are a lot of highly educated, highly trained people who lived, including in the United States, for 30-some years, who are now going back to assist this government, build the capacity that it needs. All of these reasons are encouraging, and it makes it different than the ones before. Now, have they shown anything to prove that they would be great as far as public impact? Just like the ICU did, the Islamic Courts Union did, like cleaning the streets, fixing the roads, or opening ports, and all of these things that they were doing, because during that 6 months, everyone would hear every day a new thing is happening. So it was a constant improvement that was building hope. Okay. Are they doing that? Well, that's open for debate. They're not. Because there isn't a huge impact that they made on the ground yet. But that's the plan, again, where everything is hinging on a hope, the potential that it has, rather than what they have delivered already. They have four major challenges, or one might even say five, some of which mentioned lack of security and respect for the rule of law. Of course, Somalia, David said in his opening remarks, for almost two decades it was lawless. Chaos rule. And then there is the clan-based system known as the 4.5, which is we have 550 parliament members, and some are even arguing we need more. Because lack of human resources, of course. So I mentioned that there's a trend of people going there to build that capacity, but in reality, Somalia is far from being adequately equipped to compete as a functioning state, if you will. Building all the institutions have broken down. Everything has to be built from scratch. So by no means where it's supposed to be. And then lack of a disciplined army. What you have is several militias, basically, who are clan-based, who have fought against each other in the past. They were on the other side. Now they want to gather as part of the TFG. And there is no transitioning process. Make that thing possible. I mean, yesterday's enemy, today partnering now, and there's no questioning as to why you should be siding with rather than fighting against him. And then lack of function in institutions, as I mentioned. And the other question is, lately we hear erratic voices that advocate for, perhaps one option could be rewarding the two entities, Somaliland and Puntland, the northeast region of Somalia, and bypassing the TFG and giving them their money straight so that maybe they build their regions and, I don't know, beyond that, no one's saying, so that they can become independent states. Because then the argument starts as to, are states really built on purely one clan or the idea of one clan being superior to the rest? The answer is no. Somaliland itself, the whole idea of secession came about because of such grievance that some other group within the Somali context put them under their boot, right or wrong. But then if you build a state based on that same notion, you have the same problem. One, it does not take a genius to figure that out. And so far, 20 years later, neither of the two entities have offered a proposition of some sort that really invites everybody else. It would have been a great idea if instead of the secession, the North just opened its doors, kind of welcomed rest of Somalia, for example. The whole nation shifts to the North rather than... So far you have, we talk about Somalia, but in reality there are three presidents and two flags and one underway. Contest that's already going on that you, Puntland is trying to get their own flag. So imagine that. You have one recognized geographical area that's known as Somalia, yet you have these number of people. You see how complex this issue is. So the question as to should we reward it, the simple answer is yes. But how? Should the international community engage these two entities as mini states or states? That's the case, I think, and one can foresee, any objective mind can see. We will create more problems than we have now. We'll create a perpetual problem that's clan-based, and also you're going to create a situation where people are going to be, they were fighting for resources to begin with in the South, and now you shift that problem and you take it to where it was peaceful already. Not to mention the problem between the two entities that already existed, the friction that exists between Puntland and Somalia. So that's not an alternative. So the question is, how can the international community help and reward these two entities that did something good, which is establishing peace and some kind of functioning administration and so forth. Although it has, both of them, they have their own faults. But that's not what we're here right now for. But by establishing these two functioning regions, if you will, safe havens, if you will, how do you reward that? Well, we can increase the support of these two entities through the NGOs, take care of the humanitarian aspect, take care of the capacity building aspect, administration and, you know, education and so forth and so everything. But if the international community engages them as a state, where their partners, I mean, their representatives are welcomed as a state, the tension, it has already happened with Somaliland's visit, president of Somaliland's visit. On one hand, he was not received as a president, but in reality, when you look at it, one can argue both ways. There was an attempt to establish a de facto president in that area. And if you look at the State Department as to nationalities, when you scroll down, you look at Somalia, nationality Somali, and then right under it is Somaliland. Okay? Something that was not granted to the Ogadenia movement, for example, this for much longer than Somaliland. That's not to dispute one way or another, but I want to just point out and highlight the conflicting statements that exist in there, and then how to best deal with that. Because what it is, it's creating right now is a confusion that those from the Somali side, Somalilander side, Puntlander side, and what have you, are all confused. Because this thing should be streamlined. All of these 14 reconciliation processes that we heard have failed. Of course, we know the reasons. It's clan-based reasons, people that were not really up to that par to really even be sitting in that negotiation table. Reasons for putting the cart before the horse and so forth and so on. Also, there is one reason that's very seldom mentioned, which is started from the Arta. You know, first reconciliation that was really considered an authentic reconciliation that established the first transitional national government for Somalia. And that's when those who were around the table agreed to divide and kind of section the Somali problem. In other words, leave out of this room, solve the southern problem. Once you solve the southern problem, we will deal with the other issues. And everybody packed and went to south, trying to solve a problem that's interlinked and interwoven. How do you separate one from the other? How do you solve the southern problem without solving this other issues first? So that's how the first one started, which was bound to fail to begin with. In other words, they took something that was not sustainable. Then the ones that follow was based on similar propositions. Solve the one, the southern problem, we'll come back and deal with the other issues later. Well, 20 years later, we know that's not working. 14 attempts later of reconciliation, we know that's not working. So the question is, should we continue this pattern, or should we come up with a different approach than the one that was tried and tried often? In attempting to go the route of the different approach or the new paradigm, of course, it would require some of the things that Ms. Bruton talked about, focusing on development, really not in a very limited fashion, but really something that in one of my articles I call Operation 3.5. In other words, feeding that 3.5 million people who are hungry and really spending to the point that medicine and food is in abundance. People are busy just how to distribute rather than how to fight for it. Because with a limited provision, it always creates a problem. You have the syndrome of the nine cats with one piece of meat. You know, people are going to fight on that. But if you bring it in abundance, you will have a situation where the cats and rats are eating from the same site and they're not really chasing one another. They're busy on something else, basically. So that's one approach. Also, it will require an expansion of Amisom. Expansion, I said, yes. But it's in a way that's different than what the way that was being proposed over and again. Always when you hear the Amisom, it was automatically, to the average Somali, it's associated with frontline states dominated by Ethiopia under AU, so it's not going to go anywhere. The result, we've seen it. And if the force is going to do anything, as we've already established, it would have been done under the brutal two-year occupation of Ethiopia, Ethiopian occupation of Somalia. But that didn't happen. So in this case, you want to expand AMISOM. Expand it with what? Countries that are not part of this conflict. Countries that Al-Shabaab and all of these other resistance groups cannot look at, and these infidels that are invading us and taking over our countries and so forth. That mentality. So we want to diffuse that mentality. So how do you approach it? Well, countries such as Turkey already expressed interest in helping Somalia, especially after what happened December 3rd last week. You are all aware of what happened. One of the statements that Turkey issued was that they're willing to really do anything to help in this process. They have not said in public, at least, before. So Turkey is one candidate. So is Egypt. So is Pakistan. Some countries that are really Muslims that are not going to be seen as outsiders. So expand AMISOM in that. And you also create checks and balances in that process. You're not going to create just one group that's under AU and already subservient to the Ethiopian political aims and goals and objectives and so forth and so on. You're going to have a group that's totally different. So here are some policy recommendations, and I'm going to close with this and take some questions afterwards. First one is, international community should get a lot of highly paid experts. Put them in a room and ask them to propose a solution to the Somali problem. And once they did that, the international community should take that list and turn it upside down. Upside down, number one being the last one. Reason is because none of the things that will work in other countries is going to work in Somalia. Simple as that. So you have to come up with a fresh idea. If it's not fresh, we're going to be repeating the same thing that we did before. And that will continue over and over and over again. So everything has to be with a new approach, with a new mindset, with something that seems unthinkable and undoable. But we know that it would be much cheaper than the bombs and the missiles and all of these other things that we have tried in the past. So that's one thing. The other thing is to suspend, of course, we established that, to suspend the sheer military option. That's also out of the... And to help civil societies to become potent power in there. And I don't mean by contesting the military, but if you deliver everything, education, medicine, food, everything else through these civil societies and empower them and create a commission to oversee that, because there is, of course, some great deal of corruption, as was recently reported by several researchers, rightly or wrongly, but we know that generally there's some corruption out there. So you want to create some checks and balances, some group that oversees these guys, whether they're delivering what they're saying they're delivering or not, and who's the ultimate beneficiary. And some groups have to be exposed in that process if they're not really fulfilling what they said they were. In other words, a new way, new approach, different than the one that we have. And then the international community can also help in the repatriation process. As I mentioned, some people are already trying to go back there. But they're taking a pay cut. They're in there in Western homes and offices and so forth, and they're just dropping everything, going there to help their country. So there has to be some level of incentive, some incentive to draw them to that kind of... And then the other thing is, of course, to resist the knee-jerk reaction that drives in the reaction every time people hear some Islamists have taken the rule of a given country. Because Islamists are not all same shade, same level of understanding the world affairs and how things work. There are some Islamists that believe that this is part of their identity. All they do, but there are some that are just saying, this is part of my identity. I cannot separate my religion from who I am. So if I'm going to make a decision, and especially a serious decision, my religion will play a role in that, whether I admit it in public or not. It will drive my sense of judgment. It will drive my decisions that I make, basically. But they respect the others. It's right to have their own religion, right to coexist with them, and so forth and so on. So you separate these groups from the intolerant ones that are basically anti-Islamic, un-Islamic, as most of the scholars would agree, but that's a different debate in a different day. Separate those from the great majority that see Islam as part and parcel of they are. And any time somebody denies them that right, is as though somebody denies them their right to be who they are, their right to be an American, their right to be Italian, their right to... This is part of one's identity and decision-making process. Do Americans make decisions that are really beneficial to their own interests? Of course they do. So as a Muslim, as an Islamist, would he make one that's beneficial to him and his interests? Of course he. Why shouldn't he? This is part and parcel of who he is. So we have to look at it from that perspective and deal with people according to whether they want to allow others space where they can exist or not. They're denying them that space, intellectual space, the physical space, and everything else, and the right to exist. And that's a different story. We can deal with them as an extremist and so forth and so on. I'll stop here because I've taken... So I thank you very much, but I'll entertain any questions that you have. Thank you.
Thank both of our presenters. They agreed on some points and disagreed on others. I think we have basis for some conversation with all of you. We have microphones set up on both sides of the room. If you want to comment or ask a question, I would ask that you come up to the one or the other of the microphones, and I will identify yourself and then...
Noor, I'm not going to comment on anything that... I did not see the first speaker, but now I was listening to that last speaker. What I would like to do is just to make certain corrections that are factual regarding Somaliland. And that is, Vika was talking about the secession of Somaliland did not secede, it withdrew from a union that it was a member of. It was not a secession, it was an independent republic before that. But two, Somaliland is not a one-clan state, it's a multi-clan state. which is a democracy, as a matter of fact, in which the president belongs to a minority color. And I do believe that he is the only president in sub-Saharan Africa who belongs to a minority color. Somaliland cannot be equated with a movement in a neighboring country like the ORLF. That's a mistake. So I just want to make those corrections, and I will leave the rest of the questions for other people. It's a matter of corrections only. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Yes.
My name is Abdul Ahmed. I'm from Arizona State University. I get amazed when I see armchair intellectuals in remote places having this temptation to centralize rule in Somalia or to govern Somalia. And before I get to my question, I have a very small, very brief comment that I want to say, which is Somali problem is not a political problem. It's a social problem. Puntland and Somaliland are not entities. They are quasi-states, perhaps hopefully someday independent states that organize themselves through the negotiation from bottom up, where you have with the TFGs 4.5. It's a clan system. It's hypocritical for anyone to support that and yet oppose Somaliland and Puntland. Everything wrong comes from the south. Starvation, terrorism, everything. It's really unfair for anyone to oppose the relative development that Puntland, particularly Puntland, has made. One quasi-state that still supports a possible union. So I don't understand how you talk of let's concentrate on NGOs and development when you have 200 to 1 NGOs. Mogadishu's got 200 to 1 in Puntland. I mean, what happened in Mogadishu was ethnic cleansing. People in Puntland did not choose to go there. We talk of this small window from 2006 today, but we talk of 91. And by the way, Somalia is a fascist creation. There was no Somalia. It was a fascist scheme called La Grande Somalia. There was nothing called Somalia. Northern states had sultanates that governed themselves. Now, if the South wants to be credible, they should sort out their problems first. And then come to their brothers and ask for a possible union, which again would be to the credit of Puntland if they want to unite or not. So I think to be sincere, one has to mention those things. They are genuine grievances. You can't blame Puntland and Somaliland for being clans. Everyone is made of clans. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We'll take a couple more. Okay. You want to respond now? Or?
No, it's okay.
We'll take a couple more comments and questions and then ask our speakers to respond. Yes.
I'm Sarah Cobb. I'm faculty at the Institute for Conflict Analysis and Resolution and here at George Mason. And I have a question. I wanted to follow up on your point that you said, rather as an aside, that you'd be happy to review approaches to reconciliation that have worked in the area, and I'd like to hear about those.
Okay, we'll take one more, and then we'll...
Hi, yes, I'm Don Crum from USAID, the Office of Transition Initiatives.
Hey, Don.
We've heard Mr. Armand in terms of some of the things that he would do, but I would like to get a sense of what constructive disengagement might be. I mean, I buy the notion that U.S. policy is doing more harm than good. That seems pretty evident. But what are some particulars that would be associated with constructive disengagement?
Okay, why don't the two of you?
Saeed, I think Saad Noor, is that the correct name?
Yes.
Saad Noor. To Saad Noor and Abdul Ahmed, both of you talked about the grievance being legitimate. I am not in disagreement with that. It touches all of us. Yes, the grievance is legitimate. And yes, there is a reason for why Somaliland claimed secession, and Puntland is following suit. One is not arguing against. I'm not at least arguing against that. I feel the pain that really drove my brethren in both of those these two regions to the decisions that they're making. I'm just talking about the feasibility of that. Especially in this time and age when the global economy is the way it is, whether the world can really afford three mini-states that are all welfare states, whether that is practical or not. And in reality, it's not. So if that's the case, then the best option would be to sit down and talk through a reconciliation process the one very well articulated by Abdul Ahmed, and sit down and talk about these differences and start the grassroots movement that you mentioned and so forth and so on. That's what I'm advocating for. I'm not really here for clan politics as to, you know, whether this clan deserves or not. Other things, we have a point of disagreement whether it is a clan dominated in each of these regions or not. That's open for debate. Maybe we'll have another cup of coffee on that discussion. But my opinion is the same grievance to a certain degree. If it's not really already happening, it's bound to happen. 10 years from now, if there is a mini-state called Somaliland or mini-state called Puntland, that's exactly what's going to happen. In other words, one clan is going to be dominating and playing the same role, the same grievances that they have against the military regime of the past. And that's what my concern is.
I'm not going to touch very much on the question of Somaliland at this point, although I would like to go into it more later on. But in terms of sort of the recommended approach of constructive disengagement and what's worked in the past, I would point out that in 1991, Somalia was at war. And throughout the early 1990s, there was a state of profound nationwide violence that was underway. And in 2006, that was not the case. Throughout the later portions of the 1990s, the conflict in Somalia had normalized, and a number of the people who had been warlords became businessmen. They weren't necessarily legitimate businessmen, but they were doing business. And as they began to do business, they became very concerned about maintaining the stability of their operations. They became increasingly concerned about a moderate law and order on the ground that would allow their goods to move from place to place and would allow people to exist with a degree of predictability. And those kinds of efforts have been largely overlooked. When we talk about Somalia, we tend to think of it as a place that has been an anarchic disaster since 1991, but it's simply not the case. At the local level, the sub-clan level, there have been viable agreements between sub-clans over access to water, over access to farmlands, over access to grazing rights. And those agreements have held, and they've led to significant improvements in the lives of ordinary Somalis. And throughout all of this period, there was no problem with al-Qaeda. I mean, there was al-Ittihad in the 1990s, again, in the aftermath of an intensive international reconstruction effort in Somalia. But for the most part, Somalia was a calm, relatively calm place that the world could afford to ignore. And at bottom, what constructive disengagement suggests is that the international community needs to recognize that that was the case and to start privileging Somali local responses to the conflict over national level politics, which at this point are really insoluble. So basically, all that I'm recommending is that the best thing that could happen for Somalia at this point is not to continue fighting over who has a nominal control of Mogadishu, but really to allow the situation in 2006 to reassert itself, to allow clan fiefdoms to exist. They're not perfect, they're not great, but at this point they're the lesser of two evils. And if there's stability, then there's a better chance for reconciliation. And it will be a long and slow and painful process, but it's the best that the international community can do with the resources that it has available. What I'm suggesting is that the best way that the international community can support those processes is to use development as a tool of reconciliation, to build a road between communities, to build a well, to increase access to water, to try to work with clans to make sure that they have agreements surrounding.
Somali, wa ghalibati, wa ghalibati, so.